Hi, it's Father Dave Nix. I'm with an injured family member for a few months, so you'll hear some less lively interactions with the audiences on these podcasts from now on, since I'll be podcasting from a private residence. But these podcasts will hopefully be coming every Thursday, or at least every other Thursday, until I get settled into either being a diocesan hermit or religious life. I also hope to release blog posts, written blog posts, on Tuesdays and perhaps Saturdays too, if I can keep up. I'll be honest, the first half of tonight's podcast is boring, and the second half is going to be pretty important for navigating the doctrinal confusion of our day. But it's best to pay attention to the first half so you understand the second half. Before we get to the Arian heresy next week, I realize that there's a lot of confusion on obedience these days, and thus this has to get cleared up, since the word heretic and disobedient are getting thrown around a lot. I'm only 39, but I remember when I had my conversion about 20 years ago, and I went off to Boston College, a Jesuit university, and at that time it was the conservatives telling the liberals they were disobedient. But nowadays, the liberals are telling the conservatives that they're disobedient to Rome. So it's at least a funny time in church history. And the point of this podcast today, before we jump back into the Arian heresies, the heresies of the 4th century, the 5th century, is one, I want to give you a good way to answer the people who might claim you're being disobedient for holding what Christ and all the doctors and fathers and saints always taught. And secondly, to help answer the question, who did the saints listen to in a church crisis? So even though we're going to use some big theological terms, I think by the end of this, everyone will be able to hash out, parse out the three different levels of what we're going to hear is divine law and ecclesial law and particular law, so that we really understand who to be obedient to in those things. So I think before we look more at this big battle of Arius versus Athanasius next week, we have to see the level of authority that informs someone like Athanasius to stand strong. And this is extremely critical to navigating our own current doctrinal confusion that we read about every day if we're paying any attention to anything in the Catholic world. You know, I love Jesus Christ and the Catholic faith with my whole heart and my whole soul, my whole strength and my whole mind, or at least I want to. And I want you, my listeners, to also. So the levels of divine revelation that we're going to talk about today in terms of obedience, that's not to take love out of the equation, but only because obedience is the beginning of love. Obedience is the beginning of charity. We can't get to union with God without obedience. But if people are slinging terms of disobedience against us, we have to get to divine law before union to know what God expects of us in obedience. Obedience before love, so as to live love or charity to the full. That is, union with Jesus Christ through his Blessed Mother. And that's the point of me hammering these definitions out today. Not legalism or casuistry, but we have to get to a few of these definitions on the term law, because law is how God has made the world. Law is not arbitrary, like how we often as Americans see civil law. Like how one day in 1972 in this country you can nourish an unborn baby and then the next year you can kill it. Civil law can change state to state, and really nowadays it's just become who can get away with what, really who can get away with the most. But law for St. Thomas Aquinas is actually reality. Law for St. Thomas Aquinas is actually reality, like the law of gravity. It doesn't really matter what you think about it, it just exists. Just how it is. So here's how God sees law. A few definitions for you. Natural law is how man and woman are made, how they simply are, how they were made to be, to exist, even before they come to know Jesus Christ. This is why St. Paul explains in Romans 1 that you don't need to be a Christian or even Jewish to know that alternative marriages are wrong. That's really his topic. He calls it unnatural to keep it G-rated. I call it alternative marriages to keep it G-rated. But you know what I mean. St. Paul writes in that chapter, Romans 1, this long quote, but it's really astounding because it shows that nobody, like we kind of try in our modernist theology, nobody gets an excuse of saying, I'm not in mortal sin because I didn't know it was wrong, at least for certain unnatural sins. Listen to the Apostle Paul. And he's actually talking about all of mankind being able to know part of the law of God. Why? Because it's written on our hearts, not just the hearts of Catholics, not just the law, not just on the hearts of all Christians who are baptized, not only on the hearts of anyone who believes in one God. Actually, it's even on the hearts of all pagans. Listen to what Paul writes in Romans 1, quote, "For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. For their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. And the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another. Men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done." Close quote. So nobody can claim it's not a sin to do those sins since they didn't know, say, from reading a catechism. Why? Because most of the moral issues we're now debating in the Catholic world are already written on the human heart, long before they were written in the Bible, long before they were written in St. Thomas Aquinas. They're actually on the hearts of even all pagans. So let's realize this, that errors against natural law really aren't heresy so much as just insanity. Demons literally make people insane, so we have to have compassion on them. I know that sounds condescending, but I really mean this. We can't expect people under high levels of diabolical obsession to sit down over coffee and understand our well-thought-out apologetics on why marriage should be between one man and one woman. It's just not going to happen. I don't mean that as a way of false compassion or writing them off to hell. I mean, I really have compassion for them. If you doubt my compassion for them, listen to my transgender sermon, and I explain how much I want to see Jesus Christ heal these people with a priest deliverance prayer, whether that's minor exorcism or major exorcism. More and more priests are willing to help. But going against natural law gets us attached to demons because it's totally inhuman. Natural law, that we were made to live one way and not made to live another way. Think about it. There's God, there's angels, and there's humans. If we reject God and the way that humans are supposed to live, then we're only stuck with fallen angels. So we shouldn't be surprised at these people who want, say, mutilating surgeries. We can't fight this on Fox News or apologetics or Facebook. These are demons that are only going to be cast out by prayer and fasting, or at least the triumph of the Immaculate Heart of Mary. I should say at most the triumph of the Immaculate Heart of Mary. But at the theological level, at the level of, say, a heresy podcast, here's what you have to be so clear about. Modern heretics like those promoting alternative marriages aren't actually doubting divine law. They're doubting natural law. In that sense, the Catholics promoting alternative marriage are not heretics who deny God as much as people who just deny humanity. Get it? Denying the Trinity is an old-fashioned heresy of someone like Arius, the 4th century heretic we're going to be studying next week or in 2 weeks. But those who promote alternative marriages are denying what most pagan tribes in Africa know is, well, gross, just totally gross. So you got to love the old-fashioned heretics a little bit, like Arius, for at least being concerned with Jesus Christ more than just nasty pleasures that even pagans know are filthy. So it's kind of funny that all of our modern quote-unquote heresies are pelvis issues and all the old heresies were Christological issues. Maybe even old-fashioned heretics thought about Christ more than modern Catholics, since that seems to be all we're concerned with, the pelvis issues. But, you know, this isn't a matter of divine revelation, these pelvis issues. Don't let anyone say to you, oh, you're against abortion because you're Catholic. Don't let someone say that to you. No, I'm against abortion because it's wrong to put a scissors into a baby's head. Sorry to be graphic in case there's kids listening, but let's not be pigeonholed into this. I don't need a master's in theology to know that, or alternative marriages. You don't need to be an Orthodox Catholic to know that certain things don't go in certain places. The plumbing just doesn't work out. People who hold to that, well, it's not heresy so much as diabolical possession, or at least a high level of obsession. So you can't be too mad at them. And, you know, I see this coming out of good Catholic families. I'm going to be blogging very soon on why men need to take the lead, not just in avoiding pornography, but leading the family in the daily rosary, because you're going to have kids really messed up if the dads aren't leading these families. I'm going to blog about that soon. But, you know, people who hold to this stuff We're just going to slip into it. It's like Fulton Sheen says that the only fish that go with the stream are the dead ones. But once we do come to know Jesus Christ, so now we're looking at this hinge between natural law and divine law. Once we come to know Christ, say a pagan who is following natural law and then becomes baptized like we read about in Acts of the Apostles, we have to realize there's three parts of supernatural law, the way that God wants a soul in sanctifying grace to live, the way that God wants the church to live. So from top to bottom, we got divine law, ecclesial law, particular law. And these are the three things I hope to teach you today. Divine law, ecclesial law, and particular law under this title of the podcast, Who Do the Saints Listen to in a Church Crisis? Well, as you can probably guess, those are delineated out, that in some things we listen to divine law, in some things ecclesial law, and in some things particular law. So I'll give you an example of each of these after I give you a definition. But I'd really ask anyone listening to this podcast to really memorize those three terms, divine law, ecclesial law, and particular law, because it will shield you against the coming confusion on obedience that we will see as a church in the next year at an unprecedented level. And it will get you ready to understand my next podcast, why St. Athanasius could stand against Arius even when Athanasius stood alone against the whole world thinking he was crazy for teaching Christ was not a – for teaching that Christ was the creator. Okay, so divine law. First, divine law. That's what God has taught us through the Bible and the magisterium. Let me say that again. Divine law is what God has taught us through the Bible and the magisterium. So a couple examples of that, that Jesus is truly present in the Eucharist, or that Mary is the Immaculate Conception and ever virgin. So for the rest of this podcast, I basically put under the title divine law the Bible, but it should actually be noted that there's five things that are infallible according to Pope Leo XIII in Providentissimus Deus. Too often we meet progressive Catholics who say that the only thing that's infallible is the two ex cathedra statements. Well, this isn't true. Here's what's infallible in the Catholic Church. Everything in the Old and New Testament, I'm going to name five things. We'll put that as one. One, the Bible. Two, councils. That's general councils that are dogmatic, like the Council of Trent. Number three, creeds. This would be like the Nicene Creed. Number four would be ex cathedra statements, like the definition of Mary is assumed into heaven and the Immaculate Conception, but the church already believed in that from the beginning. And then number five is any time the church fathers all agree on something. That would be the infallible things. We won't get into today the difference between the ordinary magisterium and the extraordinary magisterium, but you know, when I refer to divine law as the same as the Bible in the rest of this podcast, I'm not being sola scriptura or putting a block on the infallible teaching of the popes or the fathers throughout time. And there's even something called the magisterium of the saints that isn't as strong as the infallible magisterium, but it flows in concert with it entirely. So just for the sake of brevity, I'll refer to divine law as just the Bible because that is the source of all of these people. If you read St. Thomas Aquinas, his final word is never St. Thomas Aquinas says. It's the Bible and then secondarily backed up by the church fathers. So those are the things of divine law, but we won't explain all five of those every time in this. So don't think I'm being Protestant by putting the emphasis on, say, sola scriptura over the popes, but just trying to make a limitation to any novelty that we could possibly see in the 21st century, or rather are. So divine law comes from God himself. Okay, number two. Second in line is ecclesial law. Ecclesial law is something set by the Pope. For example, in the 1940s, Holy Thursday Mass was in the morning. Did you know that? Holy Thursday Mass for all your grandparents was in the morning. But around 1950, Pope Pius XII moved Holy Thursday Mass to the evening to more accurately represent when Christ gathered the apostles for the first Mass. Should he have done this? Yeah, sure, fine. A pope can do this. It's not a moral matter. Ecclesial law, he has the power to change that, and we stay obedient to it. I have no problem with it. Ecclesial law can be changed in discipline. Ecclesial law comes from a validly elected pope. But even then, you'll notice it's limited. Notice that that doesn't change the faith. The Pope can't change if Christ established the Eucharist, or rather, the Pope can't change if Christ established the Eucharist on Holy Thursday, just the timing of the Mass. That's fine. That's ecclesial law. He has power over ecclesial law. Okay, let's talk about number three. Finally, particular law is something a bishop can change for his diocese. Like in my home diocese, the archbishop made our patron Saint Francis of Assisi, I think it was 10 or 15 years ago, and he raised his feast level. Okay, great. A bishop can do that. So a bishop can't change the faith, but he can set smaller points of discipline. So to review the levels of divine revelation, or better put, law, God sets divine law in the Bible. It's actually just reality, because God didn't make himself the Trinity. He simply is the Trinity. But knowing the Trinity doesn't come from natural law, because even though Plato knew by natural law and a good life that God was one, Plato didn't believe in many gods, Plato could not have known that God was three and one. Plato couldn't have known Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, because he was several hundred years before that divine revelation of the Trinity in Jesus Christ. So that God is the Trinity is part of divine law, or it at least informs much of divine law. So that comes from God. Next level, the Pope controls ecclesial law, and finally, a bishop sets particular law of his diocese. Now, there's a lot of different permutations and things I could have chosen for which laws we look at. As I mentioned earlier, natural law, we have divine law, ecclesial law, particular law, all these different laws, but I think that these are the three laws most conflated nowadays. So please try to remember this. We must be obedient to God in matters of divine law. We must be obedient to a validly elected pope in matters of ecclesial law. We must be obedient to our bishops in matters of particular law. I once worked as a parochial vicar for a pastor who said he was against women's ordination, but then he added that if the Vatican ever allowed women's ordination, he would be all for it. Why is that wrong? Because Rome can't change divine law. Rome can only change ecclesial law, like my example of Holy Thursday Mass time. See how Rome can't change the faith of Jesus Christ? Or another way I could have responded to that pastor, I think it was about 5 years ago, is, well, that's conflating ecclesial law with divine law. So that brings up this question for our listeners. Is a male-only priesthood something of ecclesial law or divine law? The answer is divine law. Of course it's divine law, since Jesus made his first priests at the Last Supper only men. It's in the Bible. In fact, I might even make the argument that it's even deeper than that. It might just even be natural law, since it's only a man who can say, this is my body, and only the woman exemplified in the church can say, be it done unto me according to your word. But as for ecclesial law and particular law, notice how amazingly limited those last two are, ecclesial law and particular law. The pope can't change the faith, the bishop can't change the faith, a priest can't change the faith, a nun can't change the faith. So one more time, we must be obedient to God in matters of divine law, we must be obedient to a validly elected pope in matters of ecclesial law, and we must be obedient to our bishops in matters of particular law. Okay, one more example. Nobody could tell a divorced and remarried person that they could receive Holy Communion without an annulment and without grave sin. Why not? Because it's divine law. Jesus Christ himself said in Luke's Gospel, everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery, and he who marries a woman divorced from her husband commits adultery. And St. Paul said, for anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body eats and drinks judgment on himself. The word in Greek is actually condemnation. Anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body eats and drinks condemnation on himself. Rather, that's God speaking through St. Paul. So it's divine law that you can't receive Holy Communion in mortal sin. Nobody can change that. In fact, if someone were to say, oh, say a certain cleric could change someone receiving Holy Communion with a grave sin like divorce and quote-unquote remarriage on their soul, just lovingly respond to that person, actually, no pope or bishop or priest can change anything from divine law. That's our Catholic faith. That's not me saying this. That is our Catholic faith. Why? Because it comes from God. No man or woman anywhere can change the prohibition against sacrilegious communion for those living in the sin of so-called remarriage. Why? Because it's divine law and it's in the Bible. And this is going to be the key to see how Athanasius countered Arius in our podcast next week. One step down, let's just go through this one more time. We have ecclesial law, and this is often discipline, like what time we have Holy Thursday Mass again. And notice how limited the changes granted to even the Vatican have with our Holy Catholic faith. Yes, only a pope can change ecclesial law, but never divine law. And that is, again, what's in the Bible and the established magisterium. And then finally, particular law. Again, a bishop has control over particular law of his diocese. Let's give one more example. Say, dispensation for fasting in Lent on St. Patrick's Day. A bishop can do that. But see how tiny of a domain he has when it comes to doctrine and liturgy? Nobody can change divine revelation as it's found in the Bible and secondly the Magisterium. In fact, in the 19th century, Pope Pius IX wrote a really interesting letter to Bishop Brisen where he said, quote, "If a future pope teaches anything contrary to the Catholic faith, do not follow him," close quote. Let me repeat. If a future pope teaches anything contrary to the Catholic faith, do not follow him. Now, besides the obvious shock of that quote, there's a couple things that amaze me about that. One, that Pius IX entertained that this was a possibility that a pope could teach against the Catholic faith. In fact, this actually probably disproves the set of Acontis positions, since he admits a validly elected pope could teach contrary to the Catholic faith. But two, this quote shows that there's a difference between declaring a pope to be in material heresy versus formal heresy. No one can judge a pope to be in formal heresy because he's at the highest level of the church. But even a simple peasant at the time of Pius IX could recognize a material heresy. So there's a difference. But then actually, let's switch gears a little bit. We have to be really, really clear about something. In church history, the extremely rare instance of heresy from a pope is actually a very, very different topic from that of having an anti-pope. Now, many people think that an anti-pope would automatically be a grumpy or obviously evil character like Hitler or Pol Pot in Cambodia, but there's a much more sober definition in the history of the Catholic Church to what it is to be an anti-pope. I'll read that twice. An anti-pope is a false claimant to the Holy See in opposition to the pope canonically elected. Let me read that again. An anti-pope is a false claimant to the Holy See in opposition to the pope canonically elected. So notice this would precede any heresy spoken by that putative pope. Well, wouldn't everyone catch him either by the bad conclave or later spoken heresy? You would think so. But I spent a lot of time reading and thinking about church history, so I'm going to tell you my own theory after looking at a lot of centuries, both before our own and including our own. I think that the only time that the hierarchy would categorically overlook a false claimant to the Holy See and all but ignore a pope elected canonically accurately would be a time in history when the hierarchy met all four of these prereqs, not just one or two of these, but all four of these failures. One, when most of the hierarchy would be ignorant of the Catholic faith. Two, when most of the hierarchy would care more about money and popularity than the salvation of souls. Three, when most of the hierarchy speaks only of God's love in an emotional way, and this would probably have a high correlation to men with unnatural desires, like we spoke of earlier. And this bleeds into number four, that most of this unnatural hierarchy or unnaturally desiring hierarchy would be so presumptive of God's mercy as to believe that God loves them so much in their own time of church history that God would never allow an anti-pope in their time. I'm not sure this has ever happened in church history, but if it did, then theoretically, if those four prereqs were met, if those four circles were ever to overlap like a Venn diagram, then that's probably about the only time that an anti-pope, again, a false claimant to the Holy See in opposition to the pope canonically elected, would be historically overlooked, even by the hierarchy, even if some odd bishop tried to overturn divine law. So my suggestion is this: be obedient to God in matters of divine law. Be obedient to the magisterium of every century, not just now, but the magisterium of every century in matters of ecclesial law, unless it's a discipline that is minor and allowed to be changed. And be obedient to your bishop on matters of particular law. That's the discipline of a diocese, like, say, where a priest is sent. The bishop has that power. Don't complain about it. But when you delineate between those things, divine law, ecclesial law, and particular law, then and only then can you be a sheep to hear the voice of the good pastor, Jesus Christ, speaking through the magisterium. And when you're able to delineate between those three things, that divine revelation equals divine law, and changes, very small changes in discipline our ecclesial law coming from Rome, and even smaller issues of, say, a dispensation on when we can fast or not fast on St. Patrick's Day comes at the level of a bishop, then we can really answer those people who say, oh, you're disobedient. You know, like I said, 20 years ago it was the opposite. Now we're all getting this flung at us. And also remember that Mary said 500 years ago, and in that Vatican-approved apparition called Our Lady of Good Success, she actually named the four virtues that would keep us Catholic through this, the worst crisis in history, that Mary named to be the 20th century. I wish she had added the 21st century too, but this is bleed over time, I guess. So here's the four virtues Mary said 500 years ago that we would need now to stay Catholic when she showed Blessed Mariana all of the things that we would be going through, all the confusion we'd be going through. And she said it in Spanish. Our Lady said it in Spanish to Blessed Mariana, so I'll just translate these four. One, una gran fuerza de voluntad. That's a great strength of will. Two, constancia, or in English, constancy. Number three, valor. That's valor in English, but in the Spanish it has this old world sense of guts and gallantry. Isn't that interesting that Mary, the most humble creature in all of history and in all of the universe, would tell us to have guts and gallantry to stay Catholic in this time? And finally, mucha confianza en Dios, much trust in God. So notice that following a cleric who ratifies me in my sin is not a virtue to get me to heaven, or excessive meekness before a bishop in error. These are Mary's words, not mine, that it's going to take this great strength of will to stay Catholic. She said this in a Vatican-approved apparition, that Catholics today will need a great strength of will and guts and gallantry to truly stay Catholic in these times. So, be obedient to God on matters of divine law and natural law. Nobody can change that. To a validly elected pope on matters of ecclesial law, and to your bishop in matters of particular law. So we'll pick up next week with St. Jerome, who said about 1600 years ago that one day the whole world woke up to find that it had become Arian. God bless you.